live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. I'm getting
up soon in the morning. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on the road. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about health and nutrition, including how green tea extract can boost short-term memory from a university in Japan. We're also going to look at, want a healthy alternative to coffee? Well, I'm going to talk about something you probably have not heard about that's used for a lot of different conditions. It's a real energy boost without the caffeine jitters. And it is rich in theobromide, which is a compound found in raw chocolate. It can reduce inflammation and blood pressure. It acts as a diuretic. It has lots of flavonoids and saponins, which are phytochemicals believed to have cancer-fighting benefits. I'll tell you about that. Also, how our microbiome makes us suprahuman. I'll explain how those tens of trillions of bacteria in our body benefit us and why we should be eating to encourage more and a lot more on health and healing. Then today, I would like to respond to the New York Times endorsement of Hillary Clinton. They say that, quote, voters have the choice of one of the most broadly and deeply qualified presidential candidates in modern history. Really? Here's a question. What makes the New York Times a qualified, unbiased source? If you put Hillary Clinton beside Jill Stein on every single important issue that impacts the public and our future, Stein wins, Hillary loses, which then means that something is inherently and functionally wrong with the judgments process at the New York Times. That is my opinion, but I will go into greater depth than that. I will give you dates, quotes of what the Clintons have done. Remember, you're getting them as a tag team, and why they are the least qualified people to run a country that is in such deep crisis. I'll also be sharing insights from other individuals. And then I'll also today go to part two of my testimony before the New York State Department of Health on vaccine and mandatory vaccines for doctors. This came after our important demonstration in Albany where we stopped it. Then they had the hearings. It should have been reversed. And up till this time, we have not had that mandatory process. Now, they want to make it mandatory to give flu vaccines to young kids. You would have no choice. Now, mind you, this is putting mercury in polysorbate 80 and aluminum adjuvants directly into your child. We believe the science is overwhelmingly conclusive that that is neurotoxic and could lead to all forms of learning disabilities and autism spectrum disorder. So you hear what I say and the tone in which I share my insights to this board. Now, normally, if you've seen hearings, the people holding the hearings generally do some excoriating and finger-pointing, and that didn't happen here. But listen for yourself. Also, it is my belief that the entire psychiatric field that at least those who are practicing pharmaceutical approaches to emotional conditions are a fraud. There's no science backing them up. And I have friends who are psychiatrists, and they acknowledge that. But this is going to be some additional information from Making a Killing, the untold story of psychotropic drugging. And this will provide the facts about psychotropic drugs and the huge profits they create for the pharmaceutical industry. All of these drugs being taken, not one is safe, not one. and they have not been on the market long enough, most of them, to provide sufficient long-term studies regarding their effects. They do cause addiction, and the vast majority of doctors are not aware of how high the suicide rate is. So let's say that you have a kid, a teenager, who's going through something in life, breakup, and visits the psychologist. Psychologist recommends psychiatrist. Psychiatrist, within 15, 20 minutes, recommends a drug. The kid, 3 weeks later, commits suicide. Was not suicidal before, just going through the normal angst of growing up. We have an epidemic of suicide. Is anyone paying attention? Yes, the bereaved parents are, but no one beforehand. We will address that today. As I mentioned 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I've been working on this documentary on manufacturing madness, showing you there is no science whatsoever, zip, zero, non-existent, to say that you have bipolar. These are all extremely subjective, and if you laughed and cried, they call that bipolar. So they want everybody medicated. That's the bottom line. And we'll show you who everybody is, and we'll show you who's behind it with very specifics and a lot of undercover work that will surprise you. Let's begin. We have a lot to share today. Green tea is probably not just the most commonly used herb in the tea in the world, but is the one that is best documented for all of the good things it does to our body. There are more than 8,000 scientific studies in Japan and China alone on the medicinal value of green tea. More often than not, the therapeutic value begins at about 200 milligrams and goes up from there. It's been shown to help with cancer not metastasizing, with helping with your heart. It does everything. That's why I suggest people use it and, wherever possible, decaffeinate it. This is the latest study, and this was done at the University of Shizuoka in Japan. Quote from their publication, extracts from green tea may boost a range of cognitive functions with particular benefits observed for short-term memory. 2 grams, that's 2,000 milligrams, per day. Now, you could take that in divided doses of a green tea powder for 3 months were associated with significant improvement in the mini mental state examination on the elderly. Quote, these results support the findings of previous epidemiological studies and additionally demonstrate that green tea improves cognitive function or reduces the progression of cognitive dysfunction even at the relatively low catechin and theanine concentrations that have been obtained from ordinary levels of daily green tea intake. The green tea powder uses a daily dose in this study contained as its main bioactive components 227 milligrams of catechins, that's cat, C-A-T-E, chins, C-H-I-N-S, and 42 milligrams of theanine, concentrations that are approximately equal to 2 to 4 cups of bottled or homebrew green tea a day. We know that the active ingredients, the epigallate catechin gallate, or the EGCGs, are what are really most beneficial. We know it reduces the risk of Alzheimer's and certain cancers. We know that green tea improves cardiovascular and oral health, especially your gums. And about 40% of water extracted green tea contains the polyphenols. And we know that that's really good for you. Theanine, I would go 200 milligrams, not 42. Catechins, I would do like 300 milligrams twice a day. So they were getting good results for improving cognition with what I would consider relatively low doses. Now, I'm always asked about coffee alternatives for people who want to break the habit. And when you've helped as many people off of caffeine, you know that when a lot of people are using caffeine today, they're using it throughout the day, and lots of it. You start getting above 100 milligrams, you put yourself at a risk of stroke. You end up damaging circulation to your brain. There's a lot of downside to how this is used. So anytime I can make a suggestion, I want people to have the energy, but I don't want them to have an artificial energy. So there is a native tree leaf. It's just a leaf from the Ecuadorian Amazon. And it's been brewed by the indigenous people of the rainforest for thousands of years. And in some way, it's a ritual. It does have caffeine in it. And it's prepared each morning. It's considered one of the most important healing herbs. It's pronounced Guayusay, but it's spelled Guayusa. And it helps them recall dreams. It helps them connect with a deeper level of the natural world. It induces very lucid dreaming. In fact, they call it the watchman's plant. It also gives a lot of natural energy. And women have used it for a long time because it's supposed to help with menopausal symptoms. It's not a tea, but the leaves are dried and steeped in hot water, much like the techniques used for decree tea. The leaves come from the Amazonian tree. Let me give you the proper spelling of it. Liex, L-I-E-X, then G-U-A-Y-U-S-A. It does not contain tannins. As a result, it's not astringent or bitter. It's kind of a fruity flavor and a creamy texture. And it is rich in theobromide. That's the active ingredient in raw chocolate that reduces inflammation and lowers your blood pressure and helps as a diuretic and helps your heart and helps prevent cancer. And it also is rich in what are called plyphenolates. Ply, P-L-Y, pheno, P-H-E-N-O-S-I-S, flavonoids and saponins. And those are really good cancer fighters. And they're antioxidants to reduce inflammation and stimulate the immune system. And I mentioned a few minutes ago, theanine, thea, T-H-E-A, 9, N-I-N-E. That's an amino acid that produces dopamine. And dopamine is the hormone responsible for producing a feeling of well-being. And L-theanine calms the mind, but it also increases alertness. It increases focus, improves memory, and improves learning ability. And so it's very beneficial. And is one amino acid for anyone with any form of mental illness, a mental lack of clarity, cognitive impairment, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, definitely consider theanine. So that's something that's an alternative that you could get and make yourself. Now, we know that we are made up of far more bacteria than we have cells. And we have anywhere from 60 to trillion cells, 100 trillion cells. So imagine that you have 100 trillion cells, now go 100 above that, 100 times that. That's an awful lot of bacteria. And it comes down to something very simple. Positive thoughts, positive healthy foods, clean foods, plant-based foods. You encourage and vibrate, you stimulate, and you strengthen the good bacteria. Sugar, caffeine, or carbonated beverages, I should say, high fructose corn syrup, meat, and chicken, and fish, and animal proteins and dairy, and gluten. You stimulate an overabundance, along with alcohol and pesticides and GMOs, you stimulate the production of bad bacteria. And from that, you can get yeast overgrowth like candida and have smelly breath and smelly body. And that means that inside your body, there's a whole lot of really dank putrefaction going on. So you want to cleanse. You want to cleanse, you can. You can cleanse and rebalance and then have your body healthy again. So according to Sayer G of Green Med Info, he's got a lot of good information over there, about 25,000 peer-reviewed studies that support selecting alternative healing programs. Well, once considered the cause of most disease, we just think of germs. But now we understand that we need those good germs for survival and well-being and for extending our genetic capabilities with what are called suprahuman powers, S-U-P-R-A, not S-U-P-E-R. A groundbreaking study published in the Journal of Nature titled Transfer of Carbohydrate Active Enzyme from Marine Bacteria to Japanese Gut Microbiota adds to a growing body of microbiome research challenging the prevailing genome-centric story of human evolution, namely that the extremely gradual changes in the protein-coding nucleotide sequence of our DNA are primarily responsible for the survival of our species over the eons. A 2010 Nature study found that the Japanese have a strain of bacteria in their gut loaded with both the genes and enzymes required to digest the polysaccharides found in sea vegetation, which are normally not digestible. And that's why anyone who's gone to Japan and tried some of their dishes, the rest of that day your stomach kind of gurgles, you get bloating, gas, you may get diarrhea, because their system has evolved in the bacteria to digest that sea vegetable, which is very, very common, ubiquitous in their diets. Whereas on our side, we may have food that we can consume easily. For example, I've mentioned many times that when I'm having a glass of wheatgrass each day, I had to build up, you know, from 1 ounce, then 2 ounces. And now I drink a huge glass of wheatgrass, but I also blend that with ginger, fresh ginger, and lemon. You talk about a cleanse, rejuvenation, a detoxification all in one. That's it. And natural chelator to help get heavy metals out of your body. That does it. But when I'm working with someone and they're just starting, I don't start them off with 7 or 8 ounces. They'll throw up. You start them with 1 ounce. Our bodies have to develop. So the human genome, regardless of race, holds an informational blueprint capable of producing 17 different carbohydrate active enzymes. Now, these NCA enzymes involve primarily to digest terrestrial plants, and they took millions of years to develop. The average human microbiome, on the other hand, is far more dynamic and contains more orders of magnitude than those 17 different carbohydrate active enzymes. And we have shared human genome which is capable of producing itself. One study estimates there are about 16,000 different types of these specific carbohydrate active enzymes in the human gut, in the bacteria there. And the human gut symbiont bactericides alone contain 261 carbohydrate digesting enzymes known as glycoside hydrolases and polysaccharide lysases. Realize that's a little technical, and the astounding diversity of these enzymes found within strains of bacteria is just immense. So in the lay language part, what you should understand is when you are eating any food, if you eat it in its most natural form, but digestible, for example, if you ate oats, still cut oats, but you had no water and you didn't break them into a more digestible form, you wouldn't get much nutrition out of it. You'd get a very constipated intestinal tract. But if you had water, hot water, and you let them soak and suddenly enzymes go to work, they start to break down the fiber, and then you eat it, and now the good bacteria in your gut go to work, and they work in combination, the enzymes that you're taking in, the probiotics you're taking in, plus the bacteria in your gut. There is a symbiosis. There is a harmony. Kind of look at it like this. Everyone in the crowd is singing in harmony. And that's what your gut does. If, here's the big issue, if you feed it the healthy, living, organic, clean foods that we should have, the nuts, the seeds, the nut butters, almond butter, cashew butter, raw, the germinated grains, the sprouts, sunflower sprout, fenugreek, and the pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, all the things you can feed your body in their natural form, then create a balance with what's there in the biome, and then you stay healthier. It's a cooperative evolution. Now, mind you, there's things that take millions of years, but when you consider a new study reveals that relative to the glacial pace of our genome's evolution and adaptability to ever-changing environmental and dietary conditions, epigenetic factors and modulators, which include the 100 trillion microbes in our gut and their 4.2 million genes, enable us to rapidly adapt and change and extend our genetic capabilities. And that confers significant advantages to our species for both survival and collective well-being. So, you want to be healthier? Don't eat the hot dogs, the hamburgers, the pizzas, the french fries. Don't drink the molded shakes and all the other junk, the bagels, the donuts. Because if you do, then you're working against this evolutionary symphony. And you're going to have diseases of process. Don't want to see anyone get sick. That's one way we can prevent it. That's our health and nutrition report. Let's take a little break and come back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of the people around the world who are listening right now. I'm on the road. I'm doing a lot of work. You will begin to see what I'm doing within the next few months, and then over the next 2 years, you'll be seeing on a regular basis different films, hard-hitting, socially relevant investigative reports being shared with you. But now and again, when I look at what's going on in the media, I have some concern that the people may trust the source of a story, and hence they don't challenge the veracity of the claims made in the story. I'll give you an example. Yesterday's New York Times, quote, "Voters have the chance to choose one of the most broadly and deeply qualified presidential candidates in modern history." The New York Times says that, and then goes on, "Hillary Clinton, quote, is the right choice for the Democrats to present a vision for America that is radically different from the one that leading Republican candidates offer, a vision in which middle-class Americans have a real shot at prosperity. Women's rights are enhanced. Undocumented immigrants are given a chance at legitimacy. International alliances are nurtured, and the country is kept safe." That's their perspective, and it is my opinion that they can blather about anything they wish. But let's remember, this is the same New York Times that has been extremely reluctant to tell the truth about crimes against humanity, especially if those in power are in any way ideologically or politically aligned with them. There's a long history of being caught making gross errors and faulty reports and taking weeks to correct it, thereby keeping their hidden message out in the public. Media watch groups such as FAIR annually report on media errors, and each year finds more than the previous year. The New York Times and the Washington Post top the list of media errors. It has completely ignored popular grassroots polls showing Bernie Sanders' popularity far higher than Hillary Clinton's. It has done hit pieces against Sanders just on Friday, which wrongly accused Sanders of getting big money from super PACs more than his Democratic opponents. When an actual total super PAC money is measured, Hillary leads the way hands down. It consistently focuses on Palestinian crimes, which there are, while ignoring the far larger crimes by the Israeli military and settlers against innocent Palestinians and children, as if they don't exist. It is the biggest apologist in the media in the United States. Fox tries, but the New York Times is running neck and neck. For years, the New York Times opposed legalization of marijuana to stay in tune with Washington, and only recently, just recently, changed its position. Well, do you, anyone at the New York Times, including the publisher, do you take any responsibility for all the people who, because they possess marijuana, have spent years in prison and what that meant to their families? Have you? If you have, then please tell me when you went to the prison. When I go to prison, including the Queen's House of Detention, to when prisoners are coming back into society and before they come out and they're still in prison, I went there to try to encourage them of how to make better choices. When were you in prison? Anyone at the New York Times, especially those who are writing in favor of criminalization of marijuana? And then you have Judith Miller and her false, blatantly false reporting on the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The New York Times walked lockstep with the Bush administration invasion of Iraq, the Patriot Act, and the start of the war on terror. Never wavered from this. And that's one of the reasons that Chris Hedges left the New York Times. So let's just think for a moment. What was the outcome of that? Let's just take a moment and think, just think. Did you know, New York Times, that according to Politico's John Walcott, there were some known unknowns and some unknown unknowns that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld knew about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction in September 2002, and he didn't share those with others in the run-up to war? In 2002, August, Rumsfeld had asked Air Force Major General Glenn Schaefer, head of the Joint Staff's Intelligence Directorate, for a report on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Although the report was declassified in 2011 and posted on Rumsfeld's website, then it was not previously garnered as an attention. The 8-page 2002, September 2nd, document titled Status of Iraq's Weapons of Mass Destruction Program was passed along to Rumsfeld by General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time. The general noted in his two-sentence cover memo to Rumsfeld, quote, "It is big." The report appeared on Rumsfeld's desk right in the middle of the administration's efforts to so-called educate the public about what it claimed was a serious threat from Iraq. The report noted the quote, "We've struggled to estimate the unknowns. Our knowledge of the Iraqi nuclear weapons program is based largely, perhaps 90%, on analysis of imprecise intelligence," end quote. Quote, from the Daily Kos on this, "Myers already knew about the report. The Joint Chiefs Director of Intelligence had prepared it, but Rumsfeld's urgent tone said a great deal about how seriously the head of the Defense Department viewed the report's potential to undermine the Bush administration's case for war. but he never shared the 8-page report with key members of the administration, such as then Secretary of State Colin Powell or top officials at the CIA. According to multiple sources at the State Department, White House, and CIA who agreed to speak on conditions of anonymity, instead the report disappeared, and with it a potentially powerful counter-narrative to the administration's argument that Saddam Hussein's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons posed a grave threat to the U.S. and its allies, which was beginning to gain traction in major news outlets led by the New York Times. End quote. So let me get this right. Should not that make Donald Rumsfeld obstruction issue number one? He knew the truth. There was no proof of weapons of mass destruction. Should that not also call to account the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and also Army Force Major General Glenn Schaefer and all the other people who saw the report were the ones who prepared for the war, but all of them knew, who had access to this, there was no credibility at all. And yet your Judith Miller beat the drums for war, and that caused the war. Also, we should not forget the vice president's office, because it was his office that brought in their own intelligence, manufactured it, and then, against the advice of senior CIA analysts and intelligence experts, said, this is the one we're running with. And there were people who said, but it's not true. It's not true. How can you start a war? Well, without the truth, well, we've done that many times. Not the least of which was the Vietnam War. There was no Gulf of Tonkin attack. But in any case, that was minor in some respects, because that only cost, what, 3.4 million lives? And then the bombing of Cambodia through Kissinger, who won the Nobel Prize, in peace, after he killed a half a million Cambodians, him and Richard Nixon, and the Air Force generals involved in Westmoreland. And here's your newspaper. Everyone associated with this should have quit or been fired, and none of you were. That's unfortunate, but that's the way it works. So you were right in there with the neoliberal agenda. Trans-Pacific Partnership, no different. And we might remember what the New York Times did to Ralph Nader. At the time, he had a Times column. He was one of the top five most popular people in America. So, and then you endorse this woman. Did you forget about her tag team partner, Bill? Did Clinton's policies as president really increase people's livelihoods, that they're saying, particularly the poor? Well, Bob Woodward detailed this in depth in 1994 when he showed that only 2 months in office, Bill shifted his putting people first rhetoric towards helping Wall Street and the rich run the country. Clinton let federal spending decline dramatically and in subtle ways in order to create a surplus. See, people talk about the surplus, but the New York Times and the others don't talk about where did the surplus come from? It came from gutting education, welfare, and other programs that were essential. And that's how it happened. One labor journalist said in 1999, Clinton identified less with organized labor than any other Democratic president in the 20th century. Did you forget about NAFTA, CAFTA, the World Trade Organization, the Future Commodities Trading Act, and the Glass-Steagall Act and its repeal? The entire crisis of the last 7 years was an extension of getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act and the deregulation of Wall Street. One study showed that under Clinton's 8 years, the average wage was 2% lower than the average under Reagan and Bush, and 10% less than under Jimmy Carter. Average individual poverty rate as 13.2% of the population. It was 14% under Reagan and Bush, but worse than under Nixon, and Ford. In short, Bill Clinton accomplished absolutely nothing, zero, zip, nothing, to improve conditions for working people. The New York Times is so indebted to Wall Street that, of course, it would endorse Hillary. Paul Krugman, a so-called faux liberal, an op-ed writer, endorses Hillary. Why should we be surprised? Then let's take a look at the military. The day before the impeachment vote, Clinton bombed Iraq. This forestalled the vote further and continued to do so while the House was trying to vote. What was his reason to bomb? He claimed because Iraq stopped cooperating with the UNSCOM inspectors. In fact, Iraq's cooperation had been increasing at that time. Clinton had ordered that the chief, Richard Butler, to write a report that Iraq was not cooperating. Plus, the bombing was timed with the Muslim month of Ramadan. Clinton lied, and history shows that to be the case. Clinton's sanctions of mass destruction killed over 500,000 children. That's based upon the UN's Humanitarian Affairs Department. I don't have lattes. I don't hang out with pseudo intellectuals. I don't pretend that I know something I don't. But I'm guessing that if you're supporting someone who supported the death of 500,000 children, that there must be some moral denialism inherent in the genetic makeup of people who walk through the door of the New York Times. Unless I missed it, the intentional killing of 500,000 innocent children anywhere in the world, but this case in Iraq, by the Clintons and their neoliberal warhawk dysfunctional group of sociopaths, represents genocide. So you want to support the people who committed genocide? It's your right. You can do anything you want in the New York Times. And the people actually think they're smarter by reading it, they can believe it. For those of us who actually have half a brain left, we know the game. And we respect nothing that you do. Clinton conducted bombing in Afghanistan and the Sudan. He destroyed a pharmaceutical factory. It had no relationship whatsoever to bin Laden. In 1998, they didn't even know how many civilians were killed. Why? They didn't care. He supported Turkey in its war against the Kurds and the Kurds' independence. Let me get this straight. Turkey is arming the so-called moderate terrorists, moderate beheaders, moderate crucifiers. Turkey supports them. Turkey also supports no independence for Kurds. Bill Clinton sides with Turkey and against the Kurds. Bill Clinton escalated aid to Colombia, which then sent death squads out into the drug war. He could have said what kind of drug addict he was and his brother and his Dan Lasseter and others, and did a redemption speech. He's good at that. And said this war on drugs is stupid, is hurting people, destroying society. It's over. And done all he could. And it could have been over. Instead, he doubled down. And exactly how'd that work? Over, ready for this? $1 trillion in the war on drugs. And lots of dead and disappeared people. In Mexico alone, over 100,000 dead, 80,000 missing and presumed dead. How'd that work? Bill Clinton signed a bill to increase embargoes on Cuba, banning the sale of food and medicine and clean water to Cuba. I visited Cuba. Bill, when did you go to Cuba? I chose not to stay in the hotels. I wanted to stay with people, the average Cubans. I wanted to see how they lived and what they ate. And I wanted to see the impact. Do I support Fidel Castro? Not at all. Anything about him? Not at all. But that's different than supporting the rights of Cubans. So there's a consequence when you put a ban on food and medicine and clean water. In the case of the UN-NATO-Yugoslavian war, people increasingly note the extension of bombing of civilian infrastructure. Bill Clinton ordered trains, schools, hospitals, power stations, broadcast stations, universities. Yep, 60% of all the targets were civilian. But hold on, that's against the Geneva Code. That's an act of genocide. That's a crime against humanity, except when we do it. And of course, Tom Friedman of the New York Times supported the civilian bombing all the way. Clinton knew for a long time Indonesia would interfere with the East Timor referendum, but did nothing. Then, of course, there was Rwanda. And we know that 900,000 people, mainly Tutsi, but also some Hutu, died. He knew it was coming. The UN knew it was coming. It could all been stopped. In fact, the warehouse that held the machetes and the weapons that were going to be used in the slaughter was known, and they were going to raid it. And a call came in from the UN and said, stand down. And the person overseeing the UN mission in Rwanda says, we can stop this now before it gets started. He was told to stand down. Every time he wanted to help the people, he was told, stand down. We all know no one does anything at the UN as official policy unless the United States has its imprint on it. And then we have Hillary Clinton's State Department, consistently identified as a neoconservative hawk on foreign policy issues. So, New York Times, so you favor the Iraq war? You favored supporting the anti-Assad militant terrorist groups in Syria? You favored the intervention in Libya? Have any of your reporters gone to Libya? Have you spent a week there living in the homes of people who did nothing against anyone? The most prosperous, well-educated, and free group of people in Africa, of any country, and now see that it's a completely destroyed nation? No manufacturing, no economy. And you supported that. Do you take any moral responsibility for the things you promote? Or do you play it safe, looking out the window and thinking about how much your column could do? Well, there is a consequence when you're wrong, and you're consistently wrong on all your foreign policies. And then we had the coup in Paraguay. You were on the wrong side of that. In Ukraine, you were a promoter, shamelessly promoting the wrong side of the Ukrainian debacle and the coup, and you were on the wrong side of the coup in Honduras. It's amazing how many people who don't have your resources have the truth, and with all your resources, you couldn't find the truth if you searched around every person's desk. And what did Hillary say? That she would run, she would nuke Iran if Iran ever attacked Israel with nukes? She orchestrated coups in Paraguay, Honduras, Libya, and Ukraine, perhaps Egypt. Is that what you're supporting her to do? She lied about being under sniper fire in Bosnia. Out and out lied. Why don't you call her out on it? Why don't you show the picture of her coming off the tarmac, smiling, everybody taking photographs, and then set that side by side with her saying how they were dodging sniper fire? Why don't you have one of the African-American reporters actually look at her civil rights record, her and Bill's, and report it without first asking for permission to make her look more than what she was? No African-American in America would ever vote for the Clintons if they knew their actual civil rights record. And as a fascist, perfect. Now that's different. Hey, you want to endorse her as the face of future the future power monger, she voted in favor of the Patriot Act. Most responsible for mass incarceration of any president passing his omnibus federal crime bill in 1994. Bill Clinton put more people of color in prison for nonviolent crimes than any other person in American history. How many millions of families have been adversely affected? They going to vote for? She going to do something to get their loved ones out of jail for nonviolent crimes? His welfare reform bill in 1996 was a disaster and basically taken from Gingrich's contract with America. He was America's deregulator in chief, outdoing the GOP with financial deregulation legislation, according to the Columbia Journal Review. Ended up turning against the LGBT equality with his Defense of Marriage Act, dramatically expanded the war on drugs, and rejected U.S. prison population reform under him. He expanded the death penalty and essentially was responsible for institutionalizing Monsanto into Washington and the State Department. Scandal using the IRS to conduct audits on persons opposing the Clintons, targeting citizens against government waste, American Spectator, which was burglarized three times, the National Center for Public Policy Research. And after leaving the White House, the Clintons caught looting the furniture for $200,000. And then the email gate, keeping all of her official correspondence, the Secretary of State private, and ignoring the government-mandated process of such emails. Chinagate, sell of high-tech secrets in return for donations to Clinton's 1996 re-election campaign. Consistently supports the surveillance of the public and social media. Demonized Edward Snowden. Introduced the Flag Protection Act, making it a felony to challenge the flag. And she got all the diplomats to spy at the UN. Lied about her involvement with the TPP. In 2012, Hillary Clinton called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, quote, the gold standard for trade. Cable shows she had directly told her staff to support it in its foreign affairs activities with other countries. And National Security Advisor Susan Rice commended Hillary on her work on the TPP. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So it is my opinion that the New York Times has chosen the perfect candidate to represent their ethics, their morals, and their financial and political interest. So New York Times, do all you can to get the candidate that best represents you. But for anyone who has any conscience, don't for a second think that it's a candidate that represents your interest. Those are my thoughts. I'm Gary Nall. I can assure you this is not over. We have a lot more we're going to talk about upcoming. But that's enough for today. Now we're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, instead of part two of my vaccine report, I'm going to give you part two of why you shouldn't believe that you're mentally ill because someone tells you that you don't feel comfortable in groups of people at parties, or that because you've gone through a divorce, a loss of someone, that somehow you have a brain chemical imbalance and you need an antidepressive drug to fix it. Please stay with us, back in a moment.
Today I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. And I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock.
Now, part two of our inside look on the abuses and fraud of psychiatry.
Treated by a drug which was supposed to cure all.
And so it was relatively easy, I think, to say, well, look, let's start looking at mental illness as fundamentally a matter of chemical imbalance in the brain.
Chemical imbalance is a term that's used as a marketing ploy, as opposed to anything that there's scientific evidence to support.
Nobody has yet measured, demonstrated, or created a test to show that somebody has a chemical imbalance in their brain, period.
How do you market a drug that restores the chemical balance or corrects a chemical imbalance? How can you do that in good conscience if you don't even know what one is?
The whole myth of the chemical imbalance was created to sell drugs.
And while psychiatrists and drug companies have used this myth to make billions moving vast quantities of psychotropic drugs into the bodies of unsuspecting consumers, the public has paid the ultimate price. An estimated half of all Americans who commit suicide are on psychotropic drugs. Annually, psychotropic drugs are estimated to kill more than 2.5 times more people than are killed by homicide. And who is entrusted with protecting the public against these dangerous psychotropic drugs? In the United States, it is the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, whose psychiatric drug advisory panels are dominated by psychiatrists who shuttle between the drug industry, academia, private practice, and government, the so-called revolving door.
The revolving door at FDA is one of the primary reasons why the system that we have works so poorly. That revolving door is a direct result of the fact that a group of people with the same mindset are put into positions of being regulators and in the position of being formulators and sellers and marketers.
The panels that are formed by the FDA to evaluate these drugs, the psychiatrists who are on those panels, almost all of them have conflicts of interest where they have directly or indirectly received funding from the very industry and the very parties within the industry whose drugs they are evaluating.
So there's this tight little relationship between psychiatry, pharmaceutical industry, and FDA, where they each mutually support each other, and yet the mental health of the population does not improve.
Take, for example, the FDA drug evaluation panel that approved the antidepressant Paxil. Every psychiatrist on that panel has financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. And these conflicts of interest have been rampant enough to prompt congressional investigation.
When I check these advisory committees who make recommendations to the FDA, and they're always approved after the advisory committee, I found that there were conflicts of interest. I found that many of the people on the advisory committees had never filed a proper report on stocks and bonds that they owned that might be viewed as a conflict of interest, and they're by law supposed to do that.
And this network of financial conflict of interest between psychiatry, the drug industry, and the FDA became even more entrenched in 1992 after passage of the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, also known as PDUFA. Through this bill, the FDA would be paid a fee of $100,000 per drug to ensure that psychotropic medications would be rushed through the approval process and into the hands of prescribers faster than ever.
Congress told the FDA, your job is no longer to make sure drugs are squeaky clean safe before they get out on the market. Your job now is to hurry up and get new drugs on the market faster.
It acted to set the priorities of the FDA so that if there was a fee paid for a particular drug approval, it could be put on the fast track and rushed to market with less than the usual scrutiny that the FDA would give it.
And this fast track has traded safety for sales. Since the passage of PDUFA, time spent on drug evaluation plunged from almost 2 years in 1992 to only 6 months 4 years later. Meanwhile, the number of new drugs released to the public doubled. Though fast-tracking is disastrous for public safety, it reaps huge profits for psychiatry and the drug industry, because the sooner a drug is approved, the sooner it makes money. And the money is big. Every day, the average psychotropic drug grosses over $7.7 million. One drug, Zyprexa, rakes in almost $12 million daily. And even though FDA now charges over $1 million per new drug application, the pharmaceutical fast track shows no signs of slowing.
If you look at the relationship between the FDA, the pharmaceutical industry, and the psychiatrists, there's some kind of game that they're playing there. And what is the game? Well, you could say it's money, definitely money.
And when you follow the money, you realize that there is no money in health. There's big money in disease.
That's why all you hear about is managing disease or treating disease. You don't really talk about curing disease.
And so psychiatrists have become mainstream doctors in America. And that is because of the pharmaceutical industry. They can thank the pharmaceutical industry because they become mainstream and because they have a lot more money than they used to. And the drug industry can thank them because now they have thousands of soldiers in their army distributing these drugs to everybody.
From the smallest infant to the oldest senior citizen, no one is immune from any of the hundreds of fictitious disorders invented by psychiatrists that fuel a multi-billion-dollar psychotropic drug industry. And every day, psychiatrists are casting their nets ever wider. And all it takes? Another psychiatric label.
How many people do you know who have been diagnosed with a mental disorder?
One.
With a mental disorder? Two.
I'm sure a couple.
I know a few.
About three or four personally.
Probably four.
Half a dozen?
I'd say about nine.
At least a dozen.
I'll bet I could count 15.
20 that I personally know.
My oldest son is diagnosed.
My mother was diagnosed.
Kid from my childhood.
Your friend and ex-boyfriend.
Just my grandfather and cousins.
A friend of mine, friends.
A sister, my neighbors.
Two friends.
A girlfriend.
A niece, one friend.
My mother.
All my friends, everybody I know.
An apparent flood of mental illness is all around us. Where is this coming from? Psychiatrists, whose diagnostic and statistical manual can label anyone walking the earth today as mentally ill.
Psychiatrists, I believe, they look at every human being, and they divide humans into two classes, clients and potential clients.
We see this no more prevalent in any field than in the field of the mental disorders, where one disease after another is invented and then popularized and the public is made to worry about it.
It's a disease mongering. It's the selling of sickness. You know, sometimes it's a drug in search of a market, and it's giving public awareness to minor conditions with the ultimate goal is to sell more medications. It's not caring for people.
When you run out of symptoms, you don't have any more clientele to market to. So you have to invent disease. And with psychiatric medications, you can invent diseases all day long. Look at human variation.
Everyday things like shyness, sadness, or even situational depressions like grieving, postpartum depression, they all become studied and prescriptions start to get written for these drugs. Before these drugs were introduced in the market, people who had these conditions would not have been given any drug at all. And so it is the branding of a disease, and it is the branding of a drug for the treatment of a disease that did not exist before the industry made the disease.
Case in point, shyness, a common life situation, voted by psychiatrists into their diagnostic and statistical manual under the name social anxiety disorder.
You know, people are nervous. Well, they come up with, say, social anxiety disorder, SAD, they'll call it, SAD.
And the connotation is that everybody ought to be happy and that here's a drug that can make you happy. So that a common occurrence, which is every now and again everybody's sad, we ought to be treating with a drug.
Well, then they'll get this PR firm to drum up business for this. They'll put out all these studies that find, you know, there's so many people afflicted with this SAD, you know, and they'll start putting it in magazines, they'll start putting it on TV, they'll start a patient advocacy group, that say, you know, that we're all affected by this, and then they'll come out with Paxil works for this. So they go to the FDA.
That was part two. We will continue with this on tomorrow's program. I want to thank you all for listening today. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.